chapter 7. I will be reading from page 383, most of Judges 7, but much of the message actually will be reflecting upon Judges 6. So I find it very, you will find it very helpful to have that open. But Judges 7 is that well-known story of Gideon conquering and defeating the Midianites. But to understand that, you need to know chapter 6. Early in the morning, Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all his men camped at the spring of Herod. The camp of Midian was north of them in the valley near the hill of Morah. The Lord said to Gideon, "You have too many men for me to deliver Midian into their hands. In order that Israel may not boast against me that her own strength has saved her, announce now to the people, anyone who trembles with fear may turn back and leave Mount Gilead." So 22,000 men left, while 10,000 remained. But the Lord said to Gideon, "There are still too many men. Take them down to the water, and I will sift them for you there. If I say, 'This one shall go with you,' he shall go. If I say, 'This one shall not go with you,' he shall not go." So Gideon took the men down to the water. The Lord told him, "Separate those who lap the water with their tongues like a dog from those who kneel down to drink." 300 men lapped with their hands to their mouths. All the rest got down on their knees to drink. The Lord said to Gideon, "With the 300 men that lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hands. Let all the other men go, each to his own place." So Gideon sent the rest of the Israelites to their tents, but kept the 300 who took over the provisions and trumpets and the others. So the camp of Midian, now the camp of Midian lay below him in the valley. During the night, the Lord said to Gideon, "Get up, go down against the camp, because I am going to give it into your hands. If you are afraid to attack, go down to the camp with your servant, Hira, and listen what they are saying. Listen to what they are saying. Afterwards, you will be encouraged to attack the camp." So he and Pura, his servant, went down to the outposts of the camp. The Midianites and the Amalekites and all the other eastern peoples had settled in the valley, thick as locusts. Their camels could no more be counted than the sand on the seashore. Gideon arrived just as a man was telling a friend his dream. "I had a dream," he was saying. "I had a dream of a round loaf of barley bread come tumbling into the Midianite camp. It struck the tent with such force that the tent overturned and collapsed." His friend responded, "This can be nothing other than the sword of Gideon, son of Joash, the Israelite. God has given the Midianites and the whole camp into his hands." When Gideon heard the dream and its interpretation, he worshiped God. He turned to the camp of Israel and called out, "Get up! The Lord has given the Midianite camp into your hands." Dividing the 300 men into three companies, he placed trumpets and empty jars in the hands of all of them, with torches inside. "Watch me," he told them. "Follow my lead. When I get to the edge of the camp, do exactly as I do. When I and all who are with me blow our trumpets, then from all around the camp, blow yours and shout, 'For the Lord and for Gideon.'" Gideon and the 100 men with him reached the edge of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, just after they had changed the guard. They blew their trumpets, broke their jars that were in their hands. The three companies blew the trumpets, smashed the jars, grasping the torches in their left hands and holding their right, the trumpets that they were to blow. They shouted, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." While each man held his position around the camp, all the Midianites ran, crying out as they fled. When the 300 trumpets sounded, the Lord caused the men throughout the camp to turn on each other with their swords. Thus far, the reading of God's word. I've never been to Texas, but I do know that Texans are very, very proud people. even newcomers to the state of Texas sometimes find themselves displaying bumper stickers on the back of their cars or vehicles. And one of them goes like this: "I wasn't born here in Texas, but I got here as quick as I could." And it almost sounds like the kind of, often we Albertans are compared to Texans. And we hear. One of the things that one of the things Texans are proud about is their history. Their history. I'm told that if you ever want to be a teacher in the school system there, you have to take some courses to upgrade yourself, but not just and you need to take a history course. And it's not just a history course on American history, which you would expect, but it's a history course on Texas history. And I don't know if the teachers here are required to take a course on Alberta history, but they're required to take a course on Texas history. They're just proud of their history. And one of the great moments, if you do know Texan history, I don't know too much about Texan history, but one of the great moments, the defining moments, if you will, happened in 1836 in a place called the Alamo. The Alamo. And I'm sure you've heard of that word before. There's the Alamo Dome in St. Antonio where the sports teams play. And there's a little place, a little church called the Alamo. And what happened at the Alamo in 1836 is that this small group of Texans declared that they would be free, independent. They wanted to be independent of Mexico. That's what they were at the time. The Mexican government, of course, unwilling to accept such a course of action, sent an army, not just a small army, but thousands upon thousands of soldiers to deal with this small band of rebels who included, we know this name, Davy Crockett. Davy Crockett. Well, the Mexicans arrived, and this small band of rebels, if you will, faced a critical and important decision. Would they surrender? Would they flee and run? Or would they fight, these Mexicans? Well, the leader of the band drew a line in the sand, talking to his men. And he declared, challenged his men that those who were willing to stay and fight, of course, to a certain death, because they were outnumbered just unbelievably, needed to cross that line in the sand. And all of them crossed that line in the sand, except one man. All of them died a courageous death as well. Once they crossed that line, there was no turning back. It meant death for them. But their bold action at the Alamo galvanized the attention of the entire nation, which was now determined to not allow the Mexicans to take back Texas, to retake Texas. And the battle cry became, and it is a cry that any Texan knows, "Remember the Alamo," was their battle cry as they fought the Mexicans back. It became the Republic of Texas, eventually the state of Texas. Gideon also had an Alamo kind of experience. It didn't result in his death, as it did for Davy Crockett and the others. It did result in his people being free from the invaders. In his case, it was God who drew a line in the sand and challenged Gideon to step across. And once he did, there was no turning back for him and his men, no return to the former way of life. If there's any great story in the Bible, this is one of those great stories. We all learn it when we're young, when we're kids. But we would misread it. We would misread Gideon unless we begin to understand and remember Gideon as a weak, discouraged, and defeated man that we first meet, and that's what chapter 6 is all about, and that's why I want to go down that road, hiding, simply hiding from the Midianites and doubting his God very much. This was not a man of faith at first. But God had begun a healing process, a change, a transformation in Gideon's life. And this morning I want us to consider for a moment that change, how we, like Gideon, can be used, can be changed, can be used by God for an assignment, for a purpose, to further God's kingdom in whatever God has called us to. So I want us to consider how we are very much like Gideon. That we're very much like Gideon, and that we often deem ourselves as, well, who, me? I can't do anything. I'm useless to God. But God comes alongside of us amidst our fears and our failures and our faults. And actually, that one song we were singing talked about our fears and our failures earlier. And he comes along our fears and our failures and our faults and our foibles, and he accomplishes exactly what he wants as he furthers his plan of redemption. So yes, our fears and our failures and our faults. You might not recognize it, and I've already hinted at it. You might not recognize it in the words of chapter 7 and how heroic Gideon is. But this is not really a hero, at least not at first. You need to get to this point, and chapter 6 is getting there. One of the things we need to understand about Gideon and the Israelites at this point is they have endured 7 consecutive years, 7 consecutive years of crop failure. And we often pray for our farmers that the crop will be bountiful and that they can harvest the crop. It wasn't because of the weather for them. It is because of these raids, these brutally destructive raids by their neighboring Midianites. According to the story, the power of the Midianites was so oppressive that the Israelites prepared shelters for themselves. They didn't live in their homes come harvest time. They hid out in the mountains, in the caves, in shelters. The Midianites, as the story goes, camped out in the fields, ruined the crops. They took the crops for themselves, and what they didn't need, they probably burned or just laid to waste. But in other words, the Israelites had crop failure after crop failure 7 years in a row because they couldn't get at them. And each year they put in the seeds, knowing those Midianites, this is their food. Anyways, it wasn't good times for the. It was not a good time for the Israelites. And according to chapter 6, according to God's perspective on things, they only have themselves to blame. Only themselves. In verse 1, we're told that the Israelites did evil in the sight of the Lord, and he gave them over into the hands of the Midianites. So during this time of occupation, a young man named Gideon was attempting to thresh wheat. And in some respects, you don't blame him, because why would he want to be out in the open just giving it over to the Midianites? And the story in verse 11 of chapter 6 reads this way. The angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak of Ophrah, where Gideon was threshing wheat in a wine press to keep it from the Midianites. When the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." Now, you need to see the irony of all of this. Here Gideon is threshing wheat. And I know I've never threshed wheat, but those of us who know how to thresh wheat, you don't do it in a wine press. He is doing it, says there, where Gideon was threshing wheat in a wine press to keep it from the Midianites. Wheat needs to be threshed in the open, where the wind can get at the chaff if you throw it up. Wine presses are enclosed so that dust does not get into the wine or into the grapes or into the juices. This means that this is essentially a man in fear, a man hiding out. He's cowardly. He's hiding from the Midianites. He's scared. And for the angel of the Lord to come to him and say, "Mighty warrior," that's the word he uses, "mighty warrior, Gideon." It's almost like someone going up to a young kid who works at McDonald's, flipping burgers, and saying to him, "Greetings, O great chef." That's almost what's happening here. The title doesn't fit. The title does not fit. The situation is so obvious. Gideon is not a mighty warrior. He is not a mighty warrior. Yet that's what God calls him. The angel of the Lord calls him. It's obvious he's afraid. He's fearful. And of course, it's not the obviousness of the fear that is the problem. There's more. Let me read verse 13. "But sir," Gideon replied, "if the Lord is with us, why has all of this happened? Where are all his wonders that our fathers told us about when they said this? Did not the Lord bring us out of Egypt? But now the Lord has abandoned us, and he's put us in the hands of the Midianites." Gideon, at this point, isn't exactly an example of great faith. In fact, he's quite skeptical about God and what God is doing. This is basically what he's saying. Where is he if he's such a great God? Where is God if he's such a great God? So you see, he's not just fearful. He questions God. It's not just questions, it's accusations, in fact. Where is this God who abandons us into the hands of the Midianites? Gideon doesn't have a whole lot of good to say at this point about God. But it's not just questions or accusations. There's more. There's more. It turns to evasion as well. Again, let me keep reading. Verse 14. "The Lord turned to him and said, 'Go in the strength you have and save Israel of the Midian's hand. Am I not sending you?' he says. 'But the Lord,' Gideon asked, 'how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my family.'" If you were to translate that, "Here I am, Lord. Send somebody else. Here I am, Lord. Send somebody else." It's not just fear that he has at this moment. It's not just that he's offended with God. This happens over and over again with Gideon. Verse 20, let me read. Verse 20, "The angel of the Lord said to him," there's this, you know, conversation going on between them. "The angel of the Lord said to him, 'Take the meat and the unleavened bread, place them on this rock, and pour out the broth.' Gideon did so. At the tip of the staff," this was in his hand, "the angel of the Lord touched the meat and the unleavened bread. Fire flared from the rock, consuming the meat and the bread, and the angel of the Lord disappeared." Why is the angel of God doing this, is the question. Why is he doing all this to Gideon? Well, because Gideon asked for a sign. He needed the reassurance, the encouragement of a sign. Verse 17, just before this is the question he asked. Gideon earlier asked, "If now I have found favor in your eyes, give me a sign that it's really you. It's really you talking to me." Should there have been any doubt, but he does ask for a sign. And God is good enough, kind enough, merciful enough to actually do it, give him a sign. Fire from the rock bursts forth at that moment, consuming it. And that ought to have been enough encouragement for anybody, you would think. Anybody, you would think. Now God, at this point, you think he'd just be on fire, not, you know, get this fire, but you think Gideon would be just, let's go, God. God has a requirement at this point. God says to Gideon, "Before you go up and conquer those Midianites, your enemy, I just want to get you a little battle ready. I have a request for you, an assignment, just a small training assignment, if you will. It's not much, just a little bit. I want you to go somewhere. I want you to go to your father's house, your family's house, to your family. And I want you to destroy the altars to Baal that they have set up." They have set these altars up towards Baal. "I want you to destroy not the enemy right now, just your family's idols. It should be easy." Verse 25. The same night the Lord said to Gideon, Take the second bull from your father's herd, the one that's 7 years old. Tear down your father's altars to Baal and cut down the Asherah pole beside it. Then build a proper kind of altar to the Lord your God on top of this height. Using the wood of the Asherah pole that you cut down, offer the second bull as a burnt offering to me. Listen, verse 27. So Gideon took 10 of his servants. He doesn't do this alone. He asked 10 of his buddies, 10 of his servants. Okay, let's do this. Takes 10 of his servants to go to his family's house and did as the Lord told him. So far, so good. But because he was afraid of his family, it says there, and the men of the town, he did it at night rather than in the daytime. I asked the question, some mighty warrior, huh? Some mighty warrior. He's afraid of his own family. So afraid that he calls upon these other men and he does it at night rather than during the daytime. The next morning, the people of the town wonder what's going on. Something happened here. We can see the smoke. We can smell the offering. The Baal idols, etc., are gone, demolished. And they ask, who did this? Who did this act of vandalism? And what does mighty warrior say at this point? Well, you can read and you can read and you can look and you can look and listen, but he says nothing. He doesn't say a thing. He doesn't step forward and saying, I did this. God told me to do this. It's none of that. But they do find out who eventually did it. The men of the town. The family finds out. And who delivers him? Who rescues him? His dad. His father. His dad says, Baal can take care of himself. You don't need to kill my son. Well, that's what mighty warrior Gideon does. He lets his dad take care of himself at this moment. It's a pattern with this mighty warrior. Yes, God will come back to Gideon soon. God will say to him, I've got a chore for you. It's called the Midianites. You need to destroy them. And what does Gideon do at this point, after seeing what God has already done? Verse 36, Gideon said to God, if you will save Israel by my hand, as you have promised, look, I will place a wool fleece on the threshing floor. There is dew only on the fleece, and all the ground is dry. Then I will know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you said. Gideon wants another sign at this point. Can you believe it? He wants another sign from the Lord. And what does God do at this point? He gives him it. He literally gives him another sign. Verse 38. And that is what happened. Gideon rose early the next day. He squeezed that fleece and wrung out the dew, a bowl full of water. And what does mighty warrior do now? Well, God, that was nice. That was pretty cool what you did. That was a nice sign. But do it the other way around. Then I really will know you are God. Would you want this Gideon in your Alamo moment? Would you want this Gideon with you on your team? Is the question. Well, I think it's easy for us to point fingers at the shortcomings of Gideon, but the truth is, we're all like him in so many respects. We're scared, we're fearful, we have our failures and faults, and we know all that. We're always looking for ways out. We deep down feel that we're kind of useless. You know, how can God use me in this world? Maybe we think God doesn't deal with people like us. Only people who have, you know, courage and strength, those kinds of people. But listen, we don't have to defend our failures and our fears and our faults. All we need to realize is that even when we're scared and feeling this way, feeling the way Gideon did, God is with us. And this is more about God than it is about us and Gideon. God is with us, and he can use us simply, no matter what.